This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. It's still October 13th, the year 2000, and Norm Sunstead and I are back for one final session this afternoon to complete his interview about his years here as Director of Housing. Norm, we have a few areas that we didn't have time to get to in the last couple of days. Let's talk a little bit about the fact that the Division of Housing got into the business of marketing housing as a way to ensure full capacity even during enrollment declines. Could you tell me how that began and how successful the endeavor was?
One of the things that was surprising to me when I arrived was the condition of our marketing materials, or I think that's the term we use nowadays. It used to be information provided about housing. Today, the term is marketing. But our material was not at the standard you would find at other places, particularly my example being Michigan. It was mimeographed kind of stuff. It should have been glossier, nicer quality, and just in keeping with the level of what would be expected of a major university. At the same time, we were in a period in which we were having some struggle filling, and I'm trying to remember what the cause of that was at the time, and I don't know that I really remember.
What years are we talking about?
These were earlier years, probably in the mid to late 80s.
Okay.
I also had tried to get by without somebody who was our publications person, and that wasn't working in an efficiency move. My goal was to try to get out of housing with no more FTE than I'd gotten into it with, and I know that's not typically the way things are done, and I don't know that I made it. I don't know at all, frankly. But tried to eliminate a position, didn't work. When we recreated it, we called it specifically marketing, and it was in many ways made up of pieces that other people had done. But we moved to a higher plane. We felt we had to, as I think the university did, come up with videotapes that were really polished and well done, representing the state and representing the university to people who are prospective students. Our publications were brought up to a higher level standard. We needed to market for conferences to increase our business. We had gotten into catering at a lot more intensive level. We didn't really have a catering operation when I came. We created one in large part because the university really wanted a high-quality catering operation, and with their great respect for Rita McCutcheon and her work mm-hmm. with recipes and food service, we created one and met a need that the university felt mm-hmm. it needed. Many of these were the chancellors that felt that the quality of what they should be providing at meetings, etc., was not what it should be, and so we got into that.
So you would cater to meetings on campus?
Yeah.
Whoever.
Prior to that, it had just been the union, and mm-hmm. I think the feeling was that they needed a better fare, frankly. Mm-hmm. And the best food service on campus was University Housing Food Services, much to Rita's credit, and so we needed to provide that to offices. And it was good for housing, provided a food service staff and a means of expressing themselves in terms of the real high-end quality of food they could do. It was also good for, I thought, the university administration to know that the people who were providing food service to their students knew food service, mm-hmm. knew how to do mm-hmm. a quality product and could do it. Mm-hmm. And I think they did that and continue to do that. But in terms of marketing, there were a lot of reasons.
Before you get to market, there's also a tradition in food servicing and housing going back to Carson Gully. Again, that word tradition is popping
yeah.
up. That,
a long tradition, sure, even before Carson Gully, but he was known to be
the
fine quality
figure.
Chef.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, I think he was hired by Don Halverson, I think is the story. Don was at some resort.
Essex Lodge in Wausau, Wisconsin.
It?
Yep.
And he found Carson Gully there and hired him, got him working here, and it was a good idea.
Well, there's a little more to it than you people wanting to can listen to Don Halverson's tape on that one, but let's proceed. Marketing.
Okay. And I think there were a lot of reasons for marketing, and I frankly don't remember what kind of enrollment problems we had. I don't think we had great problems because I think most all of the time I was here, we were in the position of trying to figure out who to turn away,
yeah.
not the other. We did need to market more on family housing when we went into this intensive construction project
yeah.
because of the transitions
yeah.
and turnovers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That got difficult. And so we got, we hired a person who's full-time in marketing, and I think that that's still evolving. I think it's probably becoming stronger as we speak. You crawl before you walk kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't think of anything profound about that, I must say.
What about the other aspect of this is this, that was during the school year. What about the summertime? You had a summer conference.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Alice Gustafson talking to me a little bit about that. Yeah. Tell me, that developed quite a bit in the 80s and 90s, didn't it?
And actually before me, I know that during the time I was there, that gross revenue on conferences was somewhere in the $3 million range, mm-hmm. which is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
A great conference program. Much of that started and then carried forward, started by George Gerda, I believe, and then Alice Gustafson mm-hmm. took that over. And Alice developed it further, and we continue to have a good, strong conference business. Most schools do it. I think Wisconsin may be one of the biggest, if not the biggest. It's a great way to bring people who aren't traditional students on campus to see the campus, to see what the university is about. Housing can help support that. They do a phenomenal job of turnaround, the custodial maintenance people. We give them almost no time to turn over the buildings from students leaving and leaving mm-hmm. them sometimes in tough shape to getting them up to sort of hotel level for
and
conferees.
You install air conditioning for them.
Huge, huge process. And most of that, frankly, was developed before I got here, and the maintenance people did a wonderful job with that.
Is this the notorious bankers' conventions?
That's one of them. The bankers' convention changed a lot through my time,
yes,
from it
did.
Being almost all men mm-hmm. to half men, half women, to I think now more women. Change in banking, too, from a lot of these people going to, I think the numbers have gotten smaller. But I remember one time we were meeting with one of the banking school's directors who wanted to have us intercede because, as he mentioned it, there was at least some one woman who was sleeping around, so to speak. And this was quite interesting to us because, of course, there had been this phenomenal history of men sleeping around.
That's why I said the notorious bankers convention. Yeah.
And questions of prostitution and the prostitutes moving in from Milwaukee to Madison at the time of bankers and so on. But I think that part of this equality in terms of men and women having opportunities for jobs, they have opportunities to do all things on an equal plane. Mm-hmm. Some of those things may not be appreciated, but that the men were aghast that women might be behaving as they had was kind of interesting. What funny story I have to tell you that I remember, and I think Alice really remembers and was shocked with, and appreciated, was we also housed Girl State, I think it was, and there was a director of Girl State. Many times the Girl State directors are women who have committed a large part of their life to it, and they mm-hmm. tend to be, frankly, in my judgment, out of tune with the era of the young women that mm-hmm. they're creating these programs for. But this particular woman was not a nice woman, but they had a habit of not paying us for the longest time, like 6 months after this conference, and this was not right. We had provided the service, we needed to get the money, and so Alice had worked with these people and hadn't had any luck. I was reasonably new as a director, and the three of us were meeting, this woman who was the sort of head bulldog of the program, Alice and myself. I don't remember her name, but I spontaneously looked across the table and I said, "So-and-so, I don't think you love us anymore." She had this shocked look on her face, as I imagine Alice did. She said, "Well, what do you mean?" And I said, "You don't pay your bills." Well, I think to this day, those bills are paid promptly. I violated her space. I violated her relationship with us, but it worked. Mm. And I always got a kick out of it. And I'll bet Alice went home and said, "Gosh, you couldn't believe what that guy said." So I need to refresh Alice of that. She got a kick out of it. But conferences was a strong program when I got here. I think it still is a strong program. We use a lot of students in doing it. The students who work with it are given a lot of responsibility and rise to it. One of the traditions, I think, that I would say goes back to Don Halverson, who was trying to run housing during World War II when there weren't people around
mm-hmm.
here,
right.
is people like Newell, George, those guys, pre-war, post-war, wound up thrown in jobs that were well above their experience to handle. Mm-hmm. And they handled it. They did a beautiful job. And I think that more times than not, people who are given a challenge rise to that challenge then they feel consumed and unable to handle it. These were, of course, very good people, exceptional people. But I've seen that throughout my work life in other locations. And frankly, on occasion, I've had that opportunity too. When I started out in Nebraska, I was given a job that I was not at a par with others and made it.
Yeah, right.
And I could have failed there too. Yeah. And some of it was work, some of it was good fortune, and it all worked out. But to the credit of Don Halverson and those folks way back, they were doing that. And hopefully we're still doing it. We expect a lot of house fellows. Our staff ratio, staff to students, is very low compared to most schools. And in most instances, our house fellows rise to that and are exceptional people.
Now, are the house fellows all still graduate students?
No. That changed well before my time. And they're virtually all undergraduates. And my personal feeling is the undergraduates are better than the graduates. The undergraduates are still committed to undergraduate life. The graduates' heads are into research and graduate school and did not, I don't think, devote the time to the job nor have the tuning for it. My personal bias is you should never hire someone before their junior year in college to be a house fellow because they're too young. And you should, and the best year they'll have is their first year. You might hire them for a second year. I would never, on my own basis, hire them for a third year. It's a hard job, it's a demanding job, and they tend to slack off on it over time. Good people, but it takes its toll. You've got, I think the ratio was some very high one, like 1 to 66 or something, very high here. And when I was an RA, it was 1 to 33 in a little college. So, but they do a heck of a job, and much to the tradition, you know, what I do believe is people are trained by what they experience themselves. So as freshmen and sophomores, when they lived in, they saw what was expected of house fellows, they saw what was expected in the culture, and they perpetuate it. If that which they saw was bad, poor quality, low standards, they would perpetuate that as well. Here they don't. I think it's a very good standard.
Well, then they are your eyes and ears out there,
yes,
too. They're just absolutely a critical link.
They're very good. And we're lucky to have young people doing that kind of work, and it's fortunate for them because they learn a lot about leadership, training, and decision making when they're in college outside of the classroom in ways that will help them throughout their career, I think.
One of the other big undertakings that occurred during your years as a director has to do with facilities, dining facilities and residence halls undergoing renovation. It seems like some of the earlier directors were in charge of building a lot of these buildings, and between Eagle Heights and this, your job was getting them back, you know, keeping them going and improving upon them. Could you talk about this rather formidable task that you were given?
It did turn out to be the cards I was dealt, and actually, as I said, I think this morning, good administration is doing what needs to be done at the time you're there. The need wasn't there to build new buildings to any great extent. The needs were specifically to try to make housing rise to the needs of the students of today and tomorrow. And that was heavily remodeling, renovation. Dining rooms had not been renovated for a long time, and they each have their own history. But over a number of years, every dining room was renovated. Some we added an atrium in Elizabeth Waters. And I think this one was my idea. I can't keep straight ideas all the time who came up with it. But we wanted to have a consolidated food service in the Lakeshore area. We couldn't figure out how to do it without spending a lot of money. And it came to me, why don't we cut a hole in the floor between the first and second floor of the Holt Commons? And we did it, put a stairwell in it, and that allowed us enough dining room space to close traditional dining in Tripp Commons. I think it's Tripp Commons, isn't it? Adams, Carson Gully.
Carson Commons, yeah.
And that worked for us. That was one of those things that I think I did have an insight on. And we over my time, consolidated to fewer food services, more efficiency, but then made these convenience stores. And probably these were Bob Fessenden's ideas. Bob was, by that time, running food service. And we needed to, again, get out of this phase of low cost at all cost and to go to providing the services students expected. Bob was very good at that. Bob, at the time, had a teenage son at home. Bob was dealing with food service all the time. Bob is a gourmet cook himself.
Oh, is he?
Bob thinks about food, cares about food, and struggles with his weight all the time. And so he was the perfect person to go to that. He had been in charge of facilities for a number of years. He was the associate director of housing. He was willing to step to the bar, rise, and take on food services, which was wonderful. Very talented in doing it. And of course, I had then Paul Evans, this talented person who could go to facilities. Alice considered it too, but decided that she wanted to stay with what she was doing. So Bob was kind of the head guy on the remodeling with the help of Paul, because Paul was doing facilities. And then we worked with whomever throughout the university to come up with designs and implement them. I know that the modern standard for dining is that you remodel every X number of years. It's short turnaround time because it's expected, but I don't think we'll ever be able to do that. But I think with Bob's watchful eye, we'll do a lot better job of staying current, and the future and students will expect it of us. Residence halls, we tried many times to put together kind of a master plan, and it was insurmountable. I think the most recent plan was one that Paul Evans put together, phasing construction over a number of years as money would allow and as buildings could be delayed. And they're in that now. I don't know that they're a third of the way through it, but it's things like sprinkler systems in all the buildings, upgrading fire alarm systems, new windows where old windows are failing, roofs, elevators. Some of this isn't terribly romantic, terribly necessary. We'd love to build more bathroom space in, and I don't know if they've done anything with it. We struggled with it. We've done some improvements in bathrooms, but it's hard to get away from gang bathrooms in residence halls. The biggest construction thing, though, in my time was Eagle Heights, and I talked to Paul Evans this morning. That's going along smartly. Should be done in the next 2 years, I believe. That will be a great accomplishment because it will set up those buildings to operate into the future. They're now funded to a level that they'll have the reserves to continue to operate on that base without having to say, are we going to have to tear them down? Mm-hmm. Are these run down? They shouldn't get in that circumstance if they're well managed. So I think those things have gone well. One of the things that we had to do, and I think probably anybody in state government needs to do, is you cannot rely on state inspectors to see that the construction you're paying for in your own unit is being done at the standard it should be. We have for years had a full-time person monitoring on a minute-by-minute basis all the construction we're doing in housing, and by God, every time we don't, something is not done to the standard it should be. There are state inspectors that housing and every other state department pay for through all these construction jobs, but you cannot rely on that to hold the standard that you should have. That kind of standard is a Newell Smith kind of standard. That is not one that necessarily Newell was involved with us on, but that is a standard that we expect. If somebody comes to work in housing as a contractor and they're going to bid on a housing job, they better know they're going to expect it to do that damn job completely, because we're not going to tolerate anything short of that. I think there must be jobs going on throughout the state that are not done at that level, because when we see what happens when we don't have somebody there, we have to think that's happening elsewhere. So we're proud of that. There's a good tradition of high expectations and holding people to their contracts in housing, and hopefully they'll continue to do it. I'm sure they will.
One of the other things I want to talk about for just a few moments was the new food plan that was developed during your term tenure as director. Mm-hmm. What could you describe it and what it had replaced?
One of the things that I remember back from being in Michigan is, I think it was 1971, I went to a National Housing Officers Conference. Bill McKinnon described this new food plan at Wisconsin, and I was really impressed with it, because through my life, even when I lived in residence halls, I was a critic of food service, that it was so narrow, so controlling. It wasn't customer-oriented, it was food service-oriented, and the students eat it or not as they chose. In fact, there were incentives to discourage, in a way, the less students ate, the less your food costs were, and the more money you had to do other stuff. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin, and Newell would tell you, those folks, that they were pressured by Irv Shane, I believe it was.
During the student riots, yes.
Said, by God, do something with this food service. And with about no time at all, they turned this thing around and came up with a food service that gave students a lot more choice. That was the a la carte system. Students paid per item as they went through the line. We took that a step further. My ideal that I did not reach, and I don't know that they ever will, would be that the food service be entirely a la carte and without a minimum charge, but we haven't gotten to that. What we did do is get to the point in which we would charge for overhead costs. We charged every student for overhead cost, and that was the cost of the back of the house, the equipment, the labor, the raw food costs. And after that, we tell any student, you can choose to eat here or not. You don't have to buy any food, or you can buy as much food as you want. And so they can get points or cash equivalents to buy food. They pay for a bowl of grapes, they pay for an item of milk. In the old system, they had to do a minimum. They had to spend so much. We switched to where there was no minimum. The concept, however, the old plan, we kept the best of that. And what I think were the best characteristics of that were that students paid for what they ate and didn't pay for what they didn't eat. And so the tendency at the checkout spot was very little thrown away. Mm-hmm. Under traditional board plans throughout the nation, students would take a full tray full of food, eat what they want, and throw the rest away. It's terribly wasteful and not cost efficient. In the plan that Newell and his folks created, people were more conscientious about just selecting what they were going to pay for and eat. We took it a step further, as I said, getting to the point to where all students paid for overhead, but after that they didn't have to eat anything. Mm-hmm. And the earlier plan had sort of five different size plans that people had to buy into one or another. They all covered overhead, but in our new plan, everybody paid the same amount for overhead. We took it to all the student associations. Mm-hmm. We met with every student government. Mm-hmm. They all liked it. They wanted to do it. We did it. Again, it's a concept here in the administration of housing that goes way back, is we do what students want. We don't do what we think they want. Mm-hmm. We ask them and they tell us. The concept, however, has one thing in mind, and that is, frankly, if you don't want to take food service, don't live in residence halls, because you're going to pay that overhead cost anyway. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And since most, if not all the time I'm here, we've had more students who want housing than we could accommodate, this is a good departure point. Mm-hmm. We have a package, it's more efficient, cost efficient for students if they all or more of them eat here, but if you don't want to do that, live somewhere else, and there are alternatives for housing, and we even have some on campus that aren't board related. Mm-hmm. So that was a change in food service. As I said, my ideal would be that we not charge any overhead, build it back into food, let every student decide whether they want to eat or not. People worry about the volume going down. Mm-hmm. If the volume goes down, the cost per student goes up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a good, reasonable argument. I'd still like to do it the other way. And if financially you could be assured that it would work, it would be something we'd do. This kind of discussion that we're having here, Barry, though, reminds me of how important it is that the administration of housing understand not only students and student services, but the business side of this operation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When I left here, I believe what we were spending on raw food, unprepared food, was something like $7 million a year. You don't mess around with that kind of money. The operating budget was $40-some million a year.
I think it was.
Yeah. And so you can't deny that. You need good, sound business practices, and Newell certainly had his background in economics. Mine wasn't that kind of background, but evolved through my work at Michigan, and Paul certainly has a good, strong business mind. The people have to be both. They have to care about the students, what students need and desire, but also know how to deal with it economically, how the finances of it work. And it's that combination that is rare in people, but also a hell of a lot of fun.
And you said earlier that it still has to be student-driven.
Yes.
And that if you try to do it the other way, that's where the heads are, the bodies are in the closets from people who try it that way.
Right.
So it's a delicate balance.
Mm-hmm.
Was this something, the food program, is this something that sort of kept evolving throughout the course of your administration, or was there a time when it was more...
There was a dramatic moment. I think it probably relates to whenever what was evolving to be clear to us is that low cost at all cost was not the way the place was going to one of... We need to provide the services people want. We did some focus groups. We did some surveying. We worked with Maury Cotter on some of these things. Did some kind of elaborate kind of scale of what mattered most to students, what they were most critical of, and what we could change what they were most appreciative of, what we should change. And out of that came some of this. And I don't know when this occurred. It was probably in the later part of the 80s, is my guess. And at that time, I asked Bob to take over food services, and Rita stayed on and worked with him. But I needed to have somebody who was really going to push change in food service, and Bob was up for it, and he has the orientation and thinking I needed. So that was how that occurred and why that occurred. And it was probably a span of a couple of years that we did most of that, although the remodeling took more time than that. We also, you know, worked on this electronic card business that the campus now uses throughout, really started in housing. The I don't know what it's called, but we needed to have an electronic system to run our food services that would be far more efficient than the old punch cards and ways of doing it. And working with, I actually convened some ADP people. I'm remembering Don Miner, Ken Fraser, I think Don Warmers, a number of people throughout the university that I thought this kind of a one-card system could matter to. And we got that going, and actually I think it's administered by the union now, which we felt was the best place to put it. And that helped us with our food service, but has turned out to be helpful to the campus. I think the students even vote with it now. A lot of support from ADP, a lot of more technical ability and knowledge in that group than mine. But we in housing needed that system, and these other people saw the wisdom in it too, and so we got it going.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Irv Shane talked to Newell about the changing the food thing. It was back in the student days of unrest, and there were a lot of food fights going on. And they took some nasty turns, and this was one way of, because of course you didn't pay for what you were eating, so you could throw it if you wanted to, but when you pay for what you eat, that reduces the tendency to heave your mashed potatoes at someone who's three tables down. I'm not sure of that, but
it must have been 70 or 71, because
that sounds about right.
I think that was it. And Bill McKinnon was the assistant director who really honchoed it. Bill moved on to Penn State. He is another person that would have easily been the director back here, but he had settled into Penn State, was the director of housing, and moved on up to upper administration there, and maybe near retirement at this point.
Interesting. You said that Bob Fessenden was put in charge of the food service. Briefly, you talked about the campus catering, but was it during Bob's tenure that the convenience stores and the pizza delivery systems were...
That was Bob's stuff. Bob was real enterprising, had novel ideas. I think he certainly had his struggles to change the momentum the food service had that was traditional in that it had history here, to change to these concepts. But they did it, and Bob did a great job with it. The convenience stores were very popular and continued to be. The pizza delivery, very popular. Pizza delivery, take this extreme. Students that live in Tripp and Adams will pay extra to have a pizza delivered from across the street in Gully to their dorm room versus to go over and get it. This is the time in which you know that service at all cost versus low cost at all cost has hit. And Bob spotted that. If there was any struggle that Bob and I'd have along the way, it was that Bob would go even further. Bob would probably put in a high-end gourmet restaurant, and he'd probably be right, they'd probably pay $10 a meal for it. And I would say that probably the staff that worked with me in housing over my time would say, although we did some of these things, that basically Sunstead was pretty damn tight with the money.
Yeah.
I would think they'd say that. And they might say not as tight as Newell, I'm not sure. But I think we did a lot to change the orientation, but I still am pretty frugal.
Well, that's not a bad way to be. You had mentioned something earlier. Let's just talk about this for a few moments. The student government input into all this. There were some changes in student government. We're talking about hall governance here, I assume?
And an overall governance structure for all of the residence halls. Actually, there was a system for residence halls and also one for family
housing. Could you just address that briefly?
When I came, there was something called the Residence Halls Advisory Council that Newell, or I don't know if it existed forever, frankly, and there were... I think there was one representative for each building, not a lot of people, seven or eight, something like that. And Newell's philosophy was a very good one, and again, it speaks to this kind of philosophy of caring what students care about. Newell's belief was, if you couldn't convince the Residence Hall Council that we should do something, we probably shouldn't do it, mm-hmm. because these are the people being served. It was a nice sized group. It was good to work with. I don't know, I think some people felt that it was small and we co-opted them, because there would, mm-hmm. I would meet with them, and the senior staff would always meet, and we met, I think, once a month or maybe more frequently, talking about whatever issues we had or they had. And it was a very amiable group. In my time, we didn't vote on anything. I treated it as, this is a chance for you to represent whatever you're hearing out there. And we shouldn't necessarily do things because five versus four think it's a good idea. We need to appreciate the varied and diverse points of view of everybody out there. And if it's a significant issue in one place, it doesn't matter that it doesn't have a majority vote. This went on for most of the time I was the director. And then toward the end of my tenure, in the last three or four years, maybe it must have been that,
WSA, Wisconsin Student Association.
Well, then I think WSA, we always had a very amiable, good respect and appreciation among administrators and students and student government and housing. WSA didn't. It always had an adversarial role, and they were embarrassed on occasion in the paper, embarrassed, raising hell, fighting among each other, fighting the dean's office. And I think we had a few people at some point decide, there's got to be something wrong with this housing administration deal, because these students are getting along too well with these bureaucrats. There's got to be something wrong with the hierarchy or the governance structure. And I think they encouraged a change to that. And we said, fine, administer any way you want to. If you'd like a different form of government, do. Some students worked with some of our ResLife staff and came up with a more elaborate representative system that had far more students involved. It became difficult. We had more students to orient to government. It was more fractious. It was more difficult. I don't know that we did as good a job as we should of relating to them. And that was less good from my perspective, harder to get good input. I don't know what it's doing now, whether they've gone back to the old or if they're into this current system. In the midst of all that, again, toward the end of my time, there was an interest in the part of the central student government, the Wisconsin Student Assembly, to get office space for student organizations, mm-hmm. and they wanted to use a room in Gordon Commons, which I didn't think was right. Students in residence halls were paying for that space, not students in general. Mm-hmm. We came up with a system, the chancellor's office wanted to do it, came up with a system in which they paid rent for the space, came up with a system by which they could use it, and the last I knew, they quit doing it after about a year because nobody used it. What they really want and need is space in the union, I think, or the headquarters of campus. That wasn't working for them. They tried this thing, it didn't work. But it was a difficult time, I thought more highly of our arrangement with respect to student representation in my earlier years than I did in the end. But I'm not objective about whether there were things I was doing that were not good about that, or whether it was the structure, or frankly some meddling on the part of the chancellor's office. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as good. Mm-hmm. But all told, I think students, the housing staff feel that it's terribly important to have students involved in decision making. Whether we at any one time have the best or the worst way of doing it, I don't know.
Yeah, that's difficult to measure.
Yeah.
You mentioned the chancellor's office. You served under three chancellors.
Uh-huh.
First of all, Irv Shane, of course, and then Donna Shalala took over, and finally David Ward, who is, as you know, leaving at the end of this year, as a matter of fact. What we should be hearing about his replacement pretty soon. Comment on your relationship with those people, on their any views that they may have on housing that are of relevance.
I think the first on Shane, I was hired during, I think, his last 3-4 years, something like that. It seems like that. Worked for Len Van Ness, as you know, he's the person I reported to. They were of the philosophy, I think, that was, you run housing, we don't want to have to get involved with it. The way it's been running is probably about the right way. They were low cost at all costs kind of people. And that was in large part their interest in it. Irv did have an interest in our getting into catering because he was wanting to have a better quality of food service at Vince. And the system office also wanted that. Then Shalala came in and...
Irv Shane sort of represented the Newell Smith approach.
I think so,
That generational, maybe a little bit too general, but...
And in truth, you know, Newell was Irv's definition of what housing should be. And fair enough and very good. Then the transition was occurring and all, and then Shalala came in, and I've always loved Art Hovey's description of this. Think of the institution as a rock, a big rock. He would say, I think, that the Shane administration was the job of the chancellor is to protect the rock. Don't let anybody touch the rock. Don't let anybody mess with the rock. It is a rock. And then Art would say, and Shalala hadn't been here a month before she has the damn rock in the air. Where's the rock? Who's got the rock? Where's the rock? It's changing. Somebody's messing with the rock. And I think he had a good description of that. She had this high energy. You know, she operated on meetings every 15 minutes. I've been to meetings with her in and out in 15 minutes in which I got direction that was insightful, wise, helpful. And if I was talking with her 2 years later on the subject, she'd remember that meeting and what went on. From my perspective, she was very good. Part of the problem, part of the support we had is that she had a background working in housing somewhere. And the other thing that I think Donna had a bias in is if someone that she trusted somewhere or another had heard that you were a good person, you had a leg up going in. And from somewhere, and I was of course known nationally in housing, she had heard that I was a good guy, and she accepted that starting out. Probably not a wise way to make decisions about people, but I thought it was good at the time.
Yeah, well.
And she said, her approach to me usually was, what do you need and how can I help you? Mm-hmm. That was refreshing and
That's
helpful.
A nice approach.
She would come in the residence hall. She invited the house fellows to her home. She was very different. I liked the environment. She trusted that we were trying to do well, and she tried to be helpful to us in trying to do well. The one thing she got me into that took me a couple of years to dig out of, back to Irv Sapoznik, who is the Hillel director. Mm-hmm. Some meeting she's at in Milwaukee, not knowing this, she says, and we serve kosher meals in the residence halls. We hadn't served kosher meals in the residence hall. We never had, and we didn't have enough volume to ever do it. But I'll tell you, it took me years to get that sorted out. We had at Michigan, when I was there, investigated and actually did serve kosher meals in one of the residence halls. And so I knew quite a bit about it. I knew how to get at the data, how to get the food here. Cost prohibitive. But Irv, Sapoznik and I spent a lot of time sorting this out, and Irv would love to have this occur, except on the Friday nights that he served kosher meals in Hillel. So we had a good time on that. I liked working with her. I don't know that I have more to say on that.
What about David Ward?
David Ward, I want to be hesitant here to say I only speak to my relationship with him with respect to housing. I didn't find him to be supportive, helpful, or good, frankly. I found him to be, to involve himself and try to make decisions about things that he didn't know the facts related to. He could lose his temper. One of my values in work is that bosses, directors, chancellors, whatever, are role models and symbols for how one is to behave, and that we should be expected to and behave at a higher level or as high a level as anyone that works for us. I do not accept anybody working for me losing their temper, becoming irrational, raising their voice. If they do, I ask them to go home. And when they feel better, because they're sick, then they can come back. No one who works with someone else deserves to be treated that way or should be treated that way. It was my experience on at least one occasion, and I'd heard of others, when David Ward would lose his temper, not be informed. He also has a tendency to be top-down versus ground-up. My goal is to run housing for students. The chancellor should have as a goal that we run housing for students and what they want. I found more often his goal being I should run housing the way David Ward wanted. I didn't have big issues with him, but I did not grow to respect him. Still don't. I suspect he's grown a lot in administration over his time. He got involved in some things in his office. On one occasion, I was asked to do something I said I won't do, and I didn't do it. And I was right, and they backed off. But I didn't get an apology. I didn't get a thank you, Norm, for standing up. And of course, it's very trying to do that, to tell your boss's boss, I'm not going to do this. I think he hired the wrong people. Hank Loeffler, to my way of thinking, is also, there are too many big egos in Bascom. David Ward has one of them. When you have someone like that, they need to hire an assistant who can bridge the gap to the working slug who's doing the university, who's running the place. Hank Loeffler was exactly the wrong person. You need somebody who is respected and appreciated by the guys in middle management who run the damn place. And I hope that they're able to hire somebody that's good, that follows him. I suspect that he's done many, many things well. I don't mean to take away from that. But I don't respect him. I didn't respect him. I don't miss him. I certainly wasn't under any pressure by him. I worked most directly for John Torfey, whom I think the world of. John is on the hand where I have five fingers of the most brilliant people I've ever worked with. John's one of them. Mm-hmm. John has his ego, and yet it doesn't come to play in terms of work. I respect him. He's the kind of guy that we could anguish, think through, struggle with an issue for weeks and months, come to some kind of half-decent idea, go in and see John, go over these facts, and he'd come up with a better idea than any of us had in 2 minutes. And I hated it, but he's very good that way. He was helpful to me in many ways. He's supportive of housing in what we do, but objective. And I think very highly of him, and I think Ward is fortunate to have him in his administration. That was a good choice. But I do not think well of Ward, and I think the university will need to do some work to follow him with somebody that's better.
Let's move up the ladder a little bit, away from these minor figures like chancellors, and talk a little bit about, or do you have much to say about either the Board of Regents? You have a peer, well, let's talk about just the board first. Did you have a occasion to appear before them very often, and what can you tell me about the...
Not very often, but probably three or four times I spoke to the board. Let me make one stop before I get to that. Working with the system staff, Catherine Lyle also had worked in housing somewhere along the line, and I thought was very good. She also would come and speak in residence halls. Very down-to-earth, very good person. I think the system has been very fortunate to have her. There are a number of people in system that I thought were very good. Ruben Lorenz was wonderful. And I found generally very good support up there. Moving on to the Board of Regents, I had occasion to go there. I don't know that I can remember all of the reasons. The ones that were most come to mind related to our decision to seek approval to renovate Eagle Heights, that huge project. And then later, going back to them with some changes, we used to have to go every year, actually, and get approval for the next year's construction plans, and then we also had to go to the building commission that the governor chaired. So we did have some visibility there. But at one stage, early on, of course, there was quite a reaction because we were raising these rents phenomenally from what they'd been up to the level that was going to fund this construction. And although at the high point the rents were comparable with like facilities off campus and in the Big Ten and so on, tenants, some of them would get deeply concerned with it. And I understand that. No one ever had their rents be too low. Everybody feels their rents too high. And when you raise it higher than inflation, when teaching fellow salaries aren't going up and that kind of thing, that's tough. But we had to do it, and there were students who worked in legislative offices and so on that would complain to legislators. So on occasion, we would wind up going over the thinking and the planning on this, and usually that worked out well. But one student got involved with his legislator, and I think the story I'd heard is that he worked in Representative Rood's office. Rood is over on the western side of the state somewhere, and I think generally a good legislator. But he called for legislative audit. That is a lot of work.
That is.
And they found some things that weren't ideal, and they're probably right. They also found, they expressed some things that I thought were terribly political. And my reaction to the Legislative Audit Bureau and its process is it was the most political aspect of state government I ever dealt with. Mm-hmm. And it's disgusting and a shame, but they wrote a report that had all kinds of innuendo and comment that weren't fact-based. And my reaction is, boy, what a deal.
Why did they do that? What were they
political about? Because they
were
supporting the legislator being in good stead with the legislator, i.e. David Rood, or whatever his name is, Rood. We got out of it, we got out of it all right, but I had to go back to the trust, or the regions. And also, Torfey was helpful because he knew Catinaugh, who was, at the time, I don't know if he still is, the head of the Legislative Audit Bureau. But my reaction is that office was just disgusting. And my reaction on another subject is to auditors. In Michigan, the philosophy of auditing is you audit randomly and as a surprise, and you catch things, you punish the dickens out of them, and that lessens the likelihood people will be misbehaving. Wisconsin's approach tends to be we audit everything all the time. Out of mistrust for government, Wisconsin creates more government than I could possibly believe. And they send out young people who have no experience to be auditors. And then they go so far as to not have them do financial audits, but they call them administrative audits. Administrative audits are reviewing your policies and procedures to see if you know what you're doing. These people are wet behind the ears right out of college. They don't know what they should be doing, let alone what the history, background, philosophy of something like university housing is. And so I found auditing to be poorly done here and too much money being spent on it. Toward the end of my time here, they had cut back on the number of auditors in the system, and I think it was a wise move. I hope they're doing audits. I hope they're doing surprise audits of housing. I hope they're doing audits all over. They should not be administrative audits because they don't know what the hell they're doing. They should be financial audits, and they should be looking to catch people doing things that are wrong and punishing them. I agree with audits, but I do think it's a wasteful way that we, in fact, were doing it before. And I spent a lot of time with people who knew nothing and trying to convince them of why we were doing things the way we were doing them. But so meeting with the regents, you found some regents were terribly well-prepared, wonderful people who asked you hard questions, but informed questions, and you weren't dancing around like a fool. There are other regions who don't prepare, don't do their work, don't know what they're doing, and I think that's true of any group of regions. I was oftentimes more impressed than I expected to be with, what is the ex-governor on the trustees or regents from Stevens Point?
Lee Dreyfus. Yeah.
I know that he could, on occasion, be hard to follow, peculiar, whatever. Any question he ever asked me about housing was a right-on question. It was a good question. And he actually had lived at Badger Village, you know.
Yes, he did. He and his wife Joyce lived there, yeah.
And I didn't have any first-hand experience with him, but I thought he was good. There were, I can't remember the names right now, but there were some that were exceptional people. And generally, I think it was a good process and a good review process. As I said in my first interview, liked the fact that they weren't looking for style, they were looking for substance. When you came to speak to them, it wasn't to see how much glitter you could put forth, but it was to communicate clearly what it is was going on. And a credible person was somebody who spoke down to earth about what was going on, not somebody who could be slick. I hope that's still the case. I think that's a Wisconsin tradition and a good one. State government, the governor's office was the building commission. We'd go there again on mostly on Eagle Heights stuff, but whenever we were doing any major construction. And that was the same mix. Some people were good, some people weren't. And actually, when Representative Rood was on the building commission and we brought stuff to him, he was quite informed to ask good questions. I think his getting involved in that audit was, as happens, you get somebody who works for you or a constituent, and you presume because you've heard one side of things that you know about them. He should have consulted with us and found out more about what we were doing before he got into it. But the audit was fair. It should have been done. I mean, the audit's results, I think, were poorly written and inflammatory and stupid in that regard, but that we would be audited is certainly fair and fine, and that did occur. The state, as I said, spends too much money on administration because it's so suspicious of state government, it creates a lot of it. Things that the governor approves is just fascinating, the nickels that he reviews. I think it's foolish, but that's what the population of the state wants, that's what we do.
You served on several committees while you were on campus. You said that there were a couple that you wanted to talk a little bit about. Could you?
I did. The one with the ID card, the electronic
right,
card,
right.
That
talk
was
about
one.
That.
Another one that I worked some on, and I'm a little vague at what it was right now, but we were trying to see if we could do more teaching in the residence halls through means of computer. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't anything going on, and I don't know if there is yet today, about getting very high quality faculty, finding a way to communicate using our computer resource labs, our wiring to all the student rooms, so that there would be another avenue. In my way of thinking, there are outstanding teachers who are professors here, and there are some that aren't very good. Isn't there a way we could get the ones who are very good in contact with all of our students more and minimize the contact students have with those who aren't very good? And so I worked with Tad Pinkerton
yeah.
Those people in DOT, got some faculty involved, and we spent some time on trying to work on that process, and I think some of that kind of got, as it should have, it was taken over by the fellow that was in charge of DeWitt at the time, and I can't remember.
Don Lukers or?
Something like that.
Who's exactly
since gone.
He's since left for Minnesota, I think, yeah.
And I felt good about that effort, but many times what people would say about housing, and I hope we continue to do, was housing gets an idea, carries it forward, tries to get it going. If it's a good idea, we should turn it over to somebody else. It's not a university housing operation. The ID card was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Newell had a number of those in his administration, and I hope that tradition continues. We shouldn't be possessive of things that we think we could administer because we thought of the idea. We should move them on to wherever it is they would best fit in the institution, and I think generally did that.
Well, that's, in a way, that's pretty remarkable, though. There's not a whole lot of ego involved. We talked about this the other day, that Newell would be willing to just pass mm-hmm. that on to whoever can do it more effectively or efficiently or not. Yeah.
Yeah, there shouldn't be ego in it. There certainly are moments. And one of the things that I would say that I didn't like, that seemed to be necessary, and I disliked and I didn't want to do, and one of the reasons that I was pleased to leave, was sales. And I had to sell university housing to the rest of the university more and more and more. And the reason for it, I think, is because other people were in sales. And every department was trying to sell themselves and competing with one another. And what a fat waste of time. I liked sort of the sense of Irv Shame way back that said, we hire you, you run housing, you do the best you can, we'll try to support you, and if we don't think you're doing a good job, we'll fire you. I like that system. Mm-hmm. That's a good system. There are so many other controls on us that we can't wander afield anyway, financial controls, civil service controls. You should look to an expert. You're such a big place. Get a good director and give them the room to administer.
Mm-hmm.
And don't politicize housing or competing interests with it versus the union versus the library versus whatever. And I found a lot of time of my time needed to be taken selling myself, selling housing, and I didn't like it. I don't like it. I don't think it's an ego thing. The ego thing isn't helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are more people around here with ego problems,
mm-hmm.
and I think Bascom's full of them. I think there's some good people up there, but there are also some huge egos, and I think their brilliance will carry them. Their self-need for gratification by being worshipped is not a Wisconsin tradition. It's disgusting and it doesn't look good.
Mm.
And we got more of that than we did when I came. So that was one of the things I'm tickled to not have to do. I don't have to sell myself. I look more relaxed, and people say that. I don't know that I was very good at it, and don't care that I wasn't very good at it. Don't intend to be very good at it. I think some other points I would make are that...
Well, it's not something one wants to be very good at either.
I should hope not. I think those who need to have people, authority over people to be fulfilled personally are probably the last people you should have over people. And I ran into that wherever I was throughout my career, and that's not a good thing. Our job as administrators is to be a steward of state government, of student money, of student residence halls in this case, and ego needs aren't in the cards. They aren't in the business. That isn't what we're about. And the goal, I think, for a successful organization is to have people who get up every day and feel as though they can play a part, contribute, that they're necessary, and that they're not doing it out of fear of their boss or to make their boss look good or that their boss will evaluate them based on some superficial basis. And I think housing's got a pretty good tradition of people being motivated for the right reasons. I will tell you a thing that Newell would say, and it's a good thing to say, and we still say it, and I love it. Newell would say, people have too much to do, have far better motivations, feel better about themselves than people who have too little to do. People who have too much to do have higher morale than people who have too little to do. My people have very high morale. He's right. In Michigan, there were so many bureaucrats running around there that if you weren't doing your job, no one knew it. At Wisconsin, when I got here, I'll tell you, everybody is needed. There, at least from my experience in housing, you feel at the end of the day that you needed to do what you did, or there was a hole left. And you needed to shore up and get after it. And that's a great value. At the end of the day, people feel better about their work. They feel like they matter. Students realize that they're doing a good job and care about what they're doing. That's a great value, and that's important. And I hope that that'll continue to be a priority here. I think it is. And again, it's probably something that preceded Newell.
Yeah, right.
And part of that value of housing.
It's just in the air you breathe over there.
Yeah.
You left Madison in February of 1998 to become vice president for finance and administration at Western State College in the very beautiful area of Gunnison, Colorado. What were your reasons for leaving?
I had been in housing for, I think, something like 32 or 34 years. And as I say it in humor, I had been in keys and meal tickets long enough, and I was turning 55, feeling, my wife and I love to ski, we don't have kids, so we have, and my wife is a professional, we both have probably more financial resources that we've been able to garner over our lives. Getting older, want to do something else, and not everybody knows this, but my wife and I had decided on our 25th wedding anniversary while we were bicycling in France that we were going to leave regardless. Without a job, we were going to move to the Southwest. We jokingly said we'll be greeters at Walmart. But we had the financial resources and the interest to spark ourselves, to challenge ourselves, to see new things, to be confronted with new things. And so we decided to leave. And just fortunately, this job came along at the same time. Of course, I knew Harry Peterson from Wisconsin, and
Harry Peterson's the president at Western State,
and had been assistant to the chancellor here. And he was looking for a particular kind of person. And again, it's one of these unique circumstances where he was looking for things that he thought I had and could help him in that job. And so we agreed to move there. One of the things I would have to say, too, is the staff, the senior staff in housing, all of whom had been there before me, who remained, were outstanding, are outstanding. And I was a little bored. I probably should have risen to new things, new struggles, and so on, and there are things that I don't think I was doing well. It was time for a change. I think it was a time for a change for the university and a time for a change for me, and an opportunity came along, but we were going to go one way or the other. I was then at the age I could retire. decided I wanted to do this other thing, so we decided to do it at Western State. And I'll probably retire permanently in another year or two. I have a lot of hobbies. I do woodworking, I restore old cars, I'm a skier, a biker, a runner, those kinds of things. So
you're not going to run out of things to do.
I've got plenty of things to do, and my wife isn't working and loving it. She's a hand weaver and designs clothing and makes the fabrics, and she's nationally known now, which is really great. Mm-hmm. She's having a wonderful time. It was time, it is time, and I think one of the things that this place does wrong is, again, it hires these directors, kind of says, you run your program, and if you don't do it too badly, we'll let you stay. There are departments at this university that somebody should be asking these directors, leave. Mm-hmm. It's time for you to go. Maybe what should happen is an emeritus director job be created, and these people go to it and provide great advice, be a part of a think tank, be a part of PR work with the university. But times are changing. They change faster. Student desires and needs change. And there are people running departments, divisions of this university that should step aside and let progress occur. And that should be dealt with. And the tendency of this university in my time here was to not do that. Mm-hmm. The thinking is, we'll make the change when that person retires.
Right. Still
that's
around, yeah.
That's not right. I got paid every day for the hours I worked. When I wasn't producing, it was time to get rid of me. I had never supported these long-term appointments. It's my general reaction that you get paid every day you work. When you aren't performing what the university wants done, they should get rid of you and get somebody else that does it. And that's true of some other areas. It was my time to leave. It was. It's time for Paul Evans and other people. It just was time for me to leave, and I think there are other departments that should be dealt with that way. There's kind of this tradition at the university that I think isn't a good one, and that's just leaving people alone. Mm-hmm. And it would be good, probably, as they do in corporate America, when the chancellor resigns, everybody else turns in their resignation and start over. Because we are a big business, and it's really important that it's done well. The state invests a lot of money in us, students invest a lot of money in us, and it should be done right.
Are you enjoying your new job?
Yes, I am. The change, the change isn't as dramatic in some ways as I thought it would be. In other ways, it is. Working in a small college, a college of just over 2,000 students, as I describe it, here I would make policy and someone would do it. There, if I make policy on the swimming pool, after I've done making policy, I go out and clean the pool. It's not quite that bad, but I know all of the custodians of the college. I know probably 2/3 to 3/4 of all of the faculty and staff of the college.
Oh my.
That's fun. This is a teaching institution. People are evaluated on their teaching ability, and that's fun. We have a broad range of students, from students who are very bright, hardworking, and able, to students who are marginal, students who are like me when I was in college. And that range is difficult for people to teach to. In the same classroom, they have people who aren't sure they should be in college at all or will be in at all, and people who are very good students, and that's tough. But it's a good environment. I like the small town environment. I was raised in a small town. We love skiing, and it's 30 miles south of Crested Butte, so we ski on the weekends. I'm liking the change, and in a year or two, I'll like retiring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking about what were problems or struggles during my time, and a growing problem was employment, employing enough people and quality people to do the work that was necessary. At the same time that students were expecting service at all cost versus low cost at all cost, as you can imagine, students want more services, and students who want those services are less inclined to want to work.
Mm-hmm.
This is a dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not resolve that in my time. It continues to be a problem. As Fanny Lemoine said to me one day, my sons quit and start jobs based on what's playing at the movies. We have a situation here in which there is a great demand for employees and few people that want to work, or fewer people available to work. That's tough. And in truth, I don't think it's that there are fewer people that want to work. It is that the demands or the needs have increased. The whole data system area is a huge expanded area that added to the number of positions that we needed in housing to fill to do work. And there aren't people proportionately to expand to do all that kind of work. So employment is a struggle. Of course, related to that is, how are you going to employ people to come to work here when they can't park here? Mm-hmm. That's a struggle. As I said the other day, it's fascinating to me that Wisconsin, that is a populist institution, has an elitist parking policy, and that Michigan, that is an elitist institution, has a populist mm-hmm. parking policy. At Michigan, everyone has the same sticker, and it's a hunting pass. You can park anywhere you can find a spot. Of course, there is more parking there. It's been built because they recognize that responsibility. At Wisconsin, we have an over-administered parking policy that we have to do because we have too little parking. But I think it's terribly unfair, and it is not a populist system for parking. And I was a part of it when I was here. That's too bad. And I must say that one of the things that I think was most reprehensible that I saw as an outside symbol that Chancellor Ward made was putting a gate on a special parking lot for people who are of high position in Bascom. Absolutely disgusting. And as we all kidded and said, well, I see the parking problem on campus has been solved. When they don't deal with that problem themselves, they are not going to deal with that problem for the rest of the campus. And frankly, a campus can operate for a far longer time on a day-to-day basis without a chancellor than it can without a custodian or a teacher in the classroom. But that's just a personal bias. So the employment's a problem, and I don't think we found a solution for it, and people still struggle with it, and it's not unique to housing. Another thing that I saw in my time here that I didn't like, don't like, and Shalala had a lot to do with it, I'm afraid, is the growth of what I call professional athletics. This school had, I think, a far more honest situation with respect to athletics than it does now. I do not understand why colleges and universities have basically professional athletics and that matters. I know that it matters to alumni, and I do not understand it. Alumni who have been successful because of what they learned and the discipline they learned in the classroom, not what they learned watching football games. But people don't seem to understand that, and I think 2,000 years from now, when people look at our culture and reflect on it and its peculiarities, the two things they're going to look at will be, my God, these people were nuts for spectator sports, and it didn't say anything that your team won when you hired somebody who came from New Jersey and paid him $6,000 or $60,000 a year or $160,000 a year. What did you win? I don't understand it. To me, it's ridiculous. The other thing that they'll look back on is how people worshiped cars. That everybody's house has at least a front that is a two-car garage, if not three. That is going to be another embarrassment that as we're reviewed 2,000 years from now. Another thing I've learned is that people are more creative when money is tight than they are creative when money is readily available. Over the years, I've continued to be and increased, I think, in my being concerned with social issues. The poor, those who have less, those who are underrepresented. But I've become fiscally more conservative, that I do think that throwing money at things doesn't tend to be a resolution, and creative thought doesn't come from it. In terms of things that I should have done better, the one that stands out to me most is I think this is a typical reaction, I don't think I was as critical of my staff as I should have been. Directors tend to rely very heavily on their assistants and associates, and they get a lot from them. They're wonderful people generally. They work hard. There were some things in the personnel area that I should have been tougher on, maybe more in the style of Newell, of a hierarchical director. My more participative style, I don't think in all situations when there was a lack of consensus that I was stern, firm, and hard enough in saying, well, by God, we're going to do it this way. And I think it came out of respect and friendship with the people I worked with. I should have kept the respect. I should have had less concern with the friendships. all of those people who have remained, and they all have, are wonderful people, very good, and I think reorganizing with a new director is a good way to go. It was time. I hope they're all fulfilled. I think they're good people. I think they will be. But it was time for them to have me gone and time for me to be gone. And it's nice that I think we're all, on the end of it, happy with that, at least satisfied with it. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, Barry, and go over this, and for whatever it's worth, it's been fun.
I just want to ask you one final question. You've been talking about different aspects of this in the last couple days, but let's close the interview by talking a little bit about the clients, about the students. Mm-hmm. How you saw them over a course of 18 years. What are the major changes, the major differences that occurred in the student population in that time?
I'm laughing, thinking about a particular year, you know, a personal styles change. And I think there was a year in, probably about the middle 80s. The days that I most focus on are the move-in days.
That's yeah, when right. They're dramatic days.
And
all right.
I swear to God, every damn one of them showed up, men and women, in runner's shorts and a T-shirt. Mm. Every one of them. There was that time when everybody wore nylon sort of running shorts and a T-shirt. And now I think it's more varied. The biggest change, of course, was low cost at all costs to service at any cost. That I think, to my way of thinking, is the biggest. Certainly there's sophistication in terms of computers. More issues with mental health. I don't think great changes in terms of drinking. Maybe we even did better on that. I would say probably maybe being more materialistic and better off in the later years than they were in the first years. The first years, I in fact used to tell the campus or the city news people, you ought to do a special on trailers. You have never seen so many varieties of homemade trailers in your life. People can whack together more things to make a trailer out of them. Some are really quite interesting. And coming in old cars, and you knew that this kid was taxing the family in terms of affording to go here, was a tremendous honor, first generation college students. And this is all not, you know, just one thing or another. Just I saw more of that than I saw toward the end, where I saw everybody driving a sports utility vehicle, kids giving no concern with the cost of things, and in other words, coming from a far more affluent background than was the case earlier on. I always got a kick out of out-of-state students having to learn that in Wisconsin, when they state a rule, they intend to enforce it. Kids who particularly come from the East Coast were always inclined to think, well, that's what they say, but I'm going to do this. And then, of course, we'd nail them. And it took them a while to kind of figure that out. And it was a good experience. And many of those Eastern people have grown to love it here and stayed here. Soglins and
Soglins is a good example.
I don't know if there's a dramatic change. Over 30-some years of working with students, I don't know that I've seen a dramatic change. I worry that access, that maybe access to higher education is harder for people who are not second generation than was the case years ago. I went to school with kids who worked all night and then went to school during the day. I came from, of course, a poorer part of Minnesota, and I think maybe some of those students can't afford to go to school at all now. I don't know for sure. I really root for the kid who works when they go to school. I would, and I've always said this, I would hire a student who on their resume had C's and had worked through school over a kid who had A's who had not worked through school. That kid that worked is organized and gave of themselves to get to the end. And I take my hat off to them and think very highly of them. One change I saw over my time was more and more legal intrusion in terms of our operation. A student would get in trouble, and I had one time literally three attorneys in my office with that student.
The litigation.
His two parents, who both were attorneys, and they had hired an attorney to come with us. Well, in all my time, and I think all of Newell's time, we made no exceptions for attorneys. We held to it, and I was fascinated at thinking, we must have a hell of a tight system here because nobody's been able to break it apart legally. And toward the end, the attorneys were coming in saying, I think you're too legalistic. Shouldn't you be more compassionate? Which really told me we had
Yeah, really.
But what I disliked about it, and I think it works its way out over time, is attorneys who were who had sons or daughters in trouble would come in with a bent, how can I get my kid off? Not, how can my kid learn from this circumstance? And the thing that's wrong about that, of course, is that kid is going to learn how to try to get off and not take responsibility for themselves. My thinking is that in two generations, they wind up being paupers, so it doesn't matter, because they're going to have such poor discipline, they're not going to do well in the outside world. You can't get off. You have to be accountable for what you do, hold to what you do, and stand up for it. Unfortunately, the brightest and the best often become attorneys and then get hooked into their own scheme, and that is, how can I win? Mm-hmm. And it isn't about winning. It's about learning. It's about compassion, being humanistic. And those who come through college and learn those things are going to be prepared for life. Those who may have learned how to win have really a short-term win. And it isn't, of course, big numbers. I had on occasion, on one occasion I remember very well, a parent coming in with a student that we'd thrown out, and he stops in the office, and I think, oh, here we go. And he came in and he said, I just came by to give my son, whatever his name was, a chance to apologize. He's not old enough to go to school here. When he is grown up, he'll come back, and I'm sure he'll do very well. And my reaction is, I'll bet he did, and I'll bet he did very well. Because that's the kind of parenting that made a difference. The kid that may have gotten off is not learning from that experience, and that's a shame. But I had far more positive experiences than negative. I never liked throwing students out, but I think getting thrown out of a dorm is not a sentence to the rest of your life being a failure. And I did have them call now and then and say, you remember me, you threw me out such and such, best damn thing that ever happened.
Isn't that funny how often that happens?
And I'd say, you know, you didn't say that at the time. But it's a standard we are expected to hold, and we did. If I was doing though something different, if I was doing it again, I'd try to do it, as I would try to be a little more flexible, a little less of this lockstep, fair is same, same is equal, treat everybody the same, no matter what the circumstances. I think it is better to accommodate to a little bit more to unique circumstances than I did. And I think that's been a trend in thinking at Wisconsin over the time I've been here, so I think that's a better arrangement. And I think Paul probably does that.
Paul Evans.
Paul Evans.
Okay, I think on that note, we will end the interview. Thank you very much.
You